It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
President Obama says it's important to remember Ebola still isolated in the United States. And Iraqi Peshmerga fighters headed to fight Islamic State militants in Syria. I'm Bill Michaels reporting from Washington. U.S. President Barack Obama says it's important for Americans to remind themselves that only two people have contracted Ebola on U.S. soil and that both are now free of the disease. President Obama spoke Tuesday, just hours after the second Texas nurse to be diagnosed with Ebola was released from the hospital. Amber Vinson told reporters Tuesday she's so grateful to be well. Mr. Obama reiterated that the best way to protect Americans ultimately is going to be to stop the outbreak at its source in West Africa.
They've increased the number of Ebola treatment units and burial teams. They've expanded the pipeline of medical personnel and equipment and supplies. They've launched an aggressive education campaign in country. The bottom line is that they're doing what it takes to make sure that medical personnel and healthcare workers from all countries have what they need to get the job done.
The Obama administration and medical experts have criticized mandatory quarantine rules in states including New Jersey as excessive. Iraqi Kurdish Peshmerga fighters are headed to Kobani, Syria, to help Syrian Kurds fight Islamic State militants for control of the town just south of the Turkish border. Kurdish officials said 80 fighters equipped with artillery and machine guns would fly to Turkey Tuesday, today, cross the border and join the battle for Kobani. Another 72 are expected to arrive later today. Turkish foreign minister said the fighters would enter embattled Kobani at any moment. This is VOA News.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
An unmanned commercial rocket that was supposed to send a cargo ship to the International Space Station exploded Tuesday, 6 seconds after liftoff from a NASA launch pad in Virginia. The privately owned rocket barely got off the ground before it blew up just after sunset on Wallops Island off the Atlantic coast. There was no one on board and no one on the ground was hurt. All the damage was limited to the so-called hazard area. Officials say the investigation has already begun. The rocket was built by Orbital Sciences Corporation. It was carrying a cargo ship stocked with more than 2 tons of food, experiments, and other supplies for the space station. Orbital Sciences is one of the 2 private companies NASA hired to fly cargo ships into orbit after the space shuttle fleet was retired in 2011. U.S. Homeland Security Chief Jay Johnson has ordered tighter security at federal government buildings in Washington and other major cities. Johnson said Tuesday the reason for the enhanced presence of federal protective officers is self-evident. Terrorist groups have called for attacks inside the United States and elsewhere, including strikes on law enforcement and other government officials. Johnson said world events, including 2 attacks in Canada last week, dictate heightened vigilance in protecting U.S. government installations. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry Tuesday laid a wreath at Canada's National War Memorial in Ottawa, where a Canadian soldier was gunned down last week. Kerry called the death of Corporal Nathan Cirillo a premeditated terrorist attack. After killing Cirillo, the gunman opened fire inside the Canadian Parliament building before being shot to death by the sergeant-at-arms. Thousands mourned Cirillo at a funeral in his hometown of Hamilton, Ontario, Tuesday. An emotional Prime Minister Stephen Harper, who eulogized the soldier as someone the entire country looks to with pride, gratitude, and deep abiding respect. Russia announced Tuesday it will recognize the results of upcoming elections in 2 separatist regions of eastern Ukraine. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said the voting scheduled for November 2nd would be important for the legitimization of power in the unrecognized People's Republics of Donetsk and Luhansk. While the rest of Ukraine headed to the polls Sunday, nearly 3 million voters were unable to cast ballots in the eastern part of the country, where months of fighting between Ukrainian government forces and Russia-backed separatists has killed more than 3,700 people. Reporting from Washington, I'm Bill Michaels, and this is VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, October 29th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. President Barack Obama meets today, Wednesday, with U.S. health workers just returning from Ebola front lines in West Africa.
They're now the strategic and operational backbone of America's response. They've increased the number of Ebola treatment units and burial teams. They've expanded the pipeline of medical personnel and equipment and supplies.
That's U.S. President Barack Obama speaking Tuesday in Washington. Ebola fears and misinformation threaten New York City's African diaspora community. South Sudan refugees in Ethiopia hope for peace in their country soon. And the U.N. Refugee Agency urges Spain not to legalize automatic returns of African migrants.
In the case of people who are coming mainly for economic reasons to Europe, our position is that whatever regulations and immigration controls should be applied to them. This, however, is not the case for refugees because, as we know, refugees could be in danger if they are returned to their countries of origin.
William Spindler is the spokesman for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe calls on legislators to align the country's laws to the new constitution. And the fifth annual Lagos Photography Festival has opened in Lagos, Nigeria. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. U.S. President Barack Obama will today, Wednesday, meet with U.S. doctors and public health workers who have just returned from the Ebola front lines in West Africa, as well as those who are getting ready to go there. He said he will thank them and also encourage them for their heroism. Mr. Obama spoke Tuesday after a phone call to members of the U.S. Agency for International Development's Disaster Assistance Response Team, known as DARD, which has been on the ground in West Africa since early August.
We deployed this DART team to West Africa back in early August. They're now the strategic and operational backbone of America's response. They've increased the number of Ebola treatment units and burial teams. They've expanded the pipeline of medical personnel and equipment and supplies. They've launched an aggressive education campaign in country. The bottom line is that they're doing what it takes to make sure that medical personnel and healthcare workers from all countries have what they need to get the job done. And the good news is that it's starting to have an impact. Based on the conversations that I had today with them, they're starting to see some progress in Liberia, and the infrastructure is beginning to get built out. That's thanks to the incredible work and dedication of folks from the United States who are leading the way in helping Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. And it's critical that we maintain that leadership.
Mr. Obama reiterated that the best way to protect Americans ultimately is to stop the outbreak at its source in West Africa. He said American healthcare workers helping West Africa should be applauded, thanked, and supported. The president said he will make sure that every policy put in place is supportive of their efforts and does not discourage them from going to West Africa.
We don't want to discourage our healthcare workers from going to the front lines and dealing with this in an effective way. Our medical teams here are getting better and better prepared and trained for the possibility of an isolated Ebola case here in the United States. But in the meantime, we've got to make sure that we continue to provide the support of health workers who are going overseas to deal with the disease where it really has been raging. Of the seven Americans treated for Ebola so far, all have survived. Right now, the only American still undergoing treatment is Dr. Craig Spencer, who contracted the disease abroad while working to protect others. And we are focused on getting him the best care possible as well. And our thoughts and prayers are with him. Meanwhile, the West African nations of Senegal and Nigeria have now been declared Ebola-free. That's in part because of outstanding work led in many cases by Americans working in coordination with those countries to make sure that we did not see an outbreak there. So the point is that this disease can be contained. It will be defeated. Progress is possible, but we're going to have to stay vigilant, and we've got to make sure that we're working together.
That's U.S. President Barack Obama speaking Tuesday in Washington, D.C. With Ebola screening now underway at major U.S. ports of entry, the threat of automatic quarantining and the possibility of an African travel ban, many in New York's African diaspora fear major economic repercussions here and in their homelands, as well as social ostracism based on misinformation and panic about the virus. VOA's Adam Phillips reports from New York.
For thousands of African immigrants living in America, a travel ban between the United States and Africa could prove catastrophic, says community leader Kofi Boateng, the Ghanaian-American director of the West Harlem Development Corporation.
Because it means they themselves are afraid or fear they may not be able to go back home to attend many important things such as funerals, attend to their businesses. A lot of the African diaspora involved in business transactions back home, and vice versa. It also means that even government officials who have to come and oversee trade missions, diplomatic activities, visit the community, also can't come. It is fear.
Boateng says the Ebola scare has already affected livelihoods in Harlem. The district is dotted with braiding salons where women, mostly from West Africa, weave hair in the African style and apply hair extensions made from African hair. Boateng says these businesses have been losing customers at a growing rate over the past 2 months, even though many of the women working there have not visited their homelands for years. Similarly, many West African taxi drivers report being shunned by New Yorkers who fear that their cab interiors may transmit the Ebola virus. Neither fear is justified by the science. Yet despite repeated announcements from public health officials about how Ebola is and is not transmitted, Boateng says the information does not seem to be getting through.
So the Africans are afraid that when issues such as travel ban and misinformation about how you contract the disease take hold, then before they know it, their kids will be thrown out of school, they themselves will lose their jobs, their family members can't get visas.
Adding to the community's distress is the realization that traditional West African customs must be modified, at least for now. Treatment of the dead and dying is one arena, says Boateng, who is helping to organize local forums to inform his community, who may in turn educate loved ones back home. Making these and other changes is a step forward, says Chika Onyani, editor and publisher of the widely read diaspora newspaper African Sun-Times. But he notes that battling the Ebola epidemic is no longer just Africa's problem.
Somebody died in Spain, somebody died in Germany, and somebody died in the U.S. It's a worldwide problem now. So let us all unite. Let's not stigmatize a group of people for what is happening.
Indications of progress are mixed. On Friday, two Bronx schoolboys from Senegal were beaten up by fellow students yelling Ebola, while downtown, Manhattan's Bellevue Hospital's isolation ward admitted New York City's first Ebola patient. The United Nations reports that an international fund it has set up to fight Ebola has collected just under half of its $1 billion goal. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
The UN Refugee Agency is urging Spain not to legalize automatic returns of people who are trying to cross into its enclaves located in North Africa. The UNHCR says stripping people of their right to request asylum could put Spain in breach of the 1951 Refugee Convention. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says people who are seeking international protection should have the possibility of being heard and their claims for asylum assessed by competent authorities. The agency says this basic right is being put at risk by a proposal by Spain to automatically return people without proper documentation when they try to cross fences into its enclaves of Ceuta and Melilla in North Africa. The two Spanish cities are the only land borders between the European Union and Africa. UNHCR spokesman William Spindler says there has been an increase in the number of people arriving irregularly through this route since 2013.
As a response to the influx, Spain's ruling party has proposed an amendment to current law to be applied exclusively at the Ceuta and Melilla borders. The proposal introduces the concept of rejection at the border, rechazo en frontera in Spanish, and aims at legalizing the current practice of pushbacks. This practice would not provide any opportunity for those fleeing persecution and conflict to request asylum.
Spindler says there's been an increase in the proportion of those coming to Ceuta and Melilla from countries torn by war, violence and persecution. He says 60% are from Syria, Central African Republic, Mali and the Democratic Republic of Congo. In 2013, he says about 4,200 people entered the enclaves irregularly by land and sea. So far this year, he says, more than 5,000 people have arrived. This includes 2,000 fleeing the conflict in Syria, most of them women and children. But the UNHCR spokesman tells VOA not all those arriving are likely to be refugees. He notes many make the journey for economic reasons.
In the case of people who are coming mainly for economic reasons to Europe, our position is that the whatever regulations and immigration controls should be applied to them. And if they don't apply for asylum or they don't qualify for asylum, they can be returned to their countries of origin. This, however, is not the case for refugees because, as we know, refugees might be in danger. Their lives or their freedom could be in danger if they are returned to their countries of origin.
Spindler notes Spain is a party to the 1951 Refugee Convention. As such, he says the government must comply with its international legal obligations to allow people to state their case for asylum. Those who qualify for refugee status, he says, must be given international protection. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It is Wednesday morning, October 29th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. Young South Sudanese refugees in camps in Ethiopia speak their minds about the South Sudan government, the rebels, and their failure to end 10 months of fighting. Martha van der Wolf reports from the refugee camps in Gambela in southwestern Ethiopia.
South Sudan President Salva Kiir met his former Vice President Riek Machar last week in Arusha, Tanzania, in another attempt to reach a peace deal. The fighting has displaced nearly 2 million people and over 200,000 have fled to neighboring countries such as Ethiopia. Gutwech Sok fled the fighting in Upper Nile State and came to Ethiopia in July. The 22-year-old student believes the fighting will stop soon. He says peace can be reached if the people of South Sudan unite and stand together. Another head of state meeting is planned in the coming days in Addis Ababa, where peace talks have been taking place for months. One major issue is establishing a transitional government of national unity. Several agreements were signed earlier this year, including a much-violated ceasefire deal. Reyat Boum is 25 years old and was a soldier in the opposition forces. He came to Ethiopia in July to bring his family into safety. He wants to go back again to fight, but doesn't have the funds for transport back to South Sudan. He believes fighting is the better option now. He says they are fighting for their rights and only if the president steps up can the war stop. Most refugee camps in the northern part of Gambela province are hosting South Sudanese who came from Upper Nile State and all are ethnic Nuers. Everyone in these camps believes no lasting peace agreement can be reached if the ethnically Dinka President Kiir remains in office. The Dinka are the largest ethnic group in South Sudan. Mr. Kiir's opponent, former Vice President Machar, belongs to the second largest ethnic group, the Nuer, and so do many of Machar's soldiers. The contested coup that Mr. Kiir accuses his former deputy of quickly turned violent and ethnic. 27-year-old Wang Diu, a Nuer himself, says people were being killed just for belonging to a certain ethnic group. He says the main reason why fighting broke out in South Sudan is tribalism. Rebecca Nyakuel is a 30-year-old mother of three. The fighting made her decide to cross the border into Ethiopia last July to keep her children safe from the war. She used to cultivate her own crops in Upper Nile State, but now depends on food distributions. She believes the country needs a new president. She says that if there's a good president, the war can stop. But the war will not end with Salva Kiir as president. Current discussions between the two warring factions are focusing on sharing power between Mr. Kiir and former Vice President Machar. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Gambela, southwestern Ethiopia.
Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe officially opened the second session of the 8th Parliament on Tuesday, urging the legislators to focus on aligning the country's laws to the new constitution, as well as reviewing and passing laws that will lead to economic development. Erwin Chifera has details from Harare.
Mr. Mugabe, who spoke for less than 30 minutes, outlined several pieces of legislation which Parliament is expected to consider during the new sitting, among them bills seeking to establish state universities in Manicaland and Gwanda, and a new tax income bill. Mr. Mugabe, who has previously refused to sign an income tax bill brought to the House by former Finance Minister Tendai Biti, said a new tax bill would be passed this session.
Mr. Speaker, sir, it is also hoped that while the new income tax bill will be enacted during this session, the Insurance Act and the Pension and Provident Funds Act will be amended to address deficiencies in the current legislation and align them with international best practice.
Some of the laws expected to be passed are part of the government's proposed economic reform agenda that will be supervised by the International Monetary Fund under the proposed new 15-month staff monitored program. These include the Debt Management Bill and the amendment of the Procurement Management Act to make it more transparent. Mr. Mugabe pointed out that Parliament would be expected to pass a new law to ensure quality health to the nation.
The Public Health Bill, which seeks to promote quality health service delivery, shall be tabled during this session. Efforts to support the ministry's recovery are set to be boosted by $89 million a loan facility concluded with the Chinese Exim Bank for the procurement of medical equipment, ambulances, and other accessories.
Mr. Mugabe said he was worried that some local people were reversing the gains of the indigenization policy by fronting foreign investors.
It is depressing that some of our people have turned themselves into mere fronts for foreign investors, thus defeating the fundamental objective of the indigenization and economic empowerment program. Decisive action shall indeed be taken to address these developments, strengthen the general enforcement of the relevant legislation.
Most of the proposed pieces of legislation mentioned by Mr. Mugabe should have been dealt with during the first session of the 8th Parliament, but only a few bills were brought to Parliament, with the Electoral Amendment Act being the only major law to be passed. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
The 5th annual Lagos Photo Festival has opened in Nigeria's economic capital, Lagos. While exhibiting and rewarding photographers' work from both Nigeria and around the globe, organizers from the African Artist Foundation are also using their cultural capital to help preserve Nigerian photographs, some of them 200 years old and currently deteriorating at the National Museum. Wunikat Mukan, brand director for the African Artist Foundation, which is holding the event, talks to Ricky Stryak both about the archiving effort and how the festival has grown.
We will be working with the National Museum on archiving a lot of these images. We've actually just had a few meetings with them. We're working with them to archive some of these images and put them online, creating a database so they're accessible to student groups and the general public. We're also working with the Nigeria Nostalgia Project. They're also an organization that works on archiving Nigerian, images and preserving a lot of these images.
I know this is Lagos Photo's fifth year. So how has it grown from the first year up until now?
It's kind of grown from this little festival where we're, sort of begging photographers to be involved. And now in the fifth year, we get so many entries. We get so much interest in people who, local and international artists working in Africa who want to show their work. Basically, in that regard, it's grown from just the number of artists and the number of locations. We started off with a very small exhibition, and now we've expanded to 7 satellite venues in Lagos, as well as 5 outdoor venues. We also show art in public spaces. And we also have a couple international exhibits in Africa as well as outside of Africa as well.
And I know this year's theme is staging reality, documenting fiction. And this examines contemporary photographers working in Africa who negotiate the boundaries and relationships between photography, beliefs, and truths. Can you give me some examples of these types of projects that you are featuring?
So a perfect example would be works from, let's say, Christina de Medel. She's a Spanish photographer. She did a series that we're showing this year. She actually shot in Lagos earlier this year in Makoko. The story is based around basically Nigeria's first novelist, Amos Tutuola, and he wrote a book called My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, and basically about this young boy whose village is attacked by soldiers. He basically goes into the jungle to escape the horrors of what is going on, and she's managed to recreate that story here in Lagos.
Wunika Mukand is the brand director for the African Artist Foundation. She was speaking with Ricky Shryak from Lagos, Nigeria. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Marco Uma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we focus on the football crisis in Nigeria. The Nigeria Football Federation, NFF, has until Friday midday to withdraw all cases before a civil court in Jos, Plateau State in north-central Nigeria, or face a lengthy suspension from international football, the FIFA Secretary General Jerome Valks wrote in a warning letter to the NFF President Amaju Pinich on Tuesday. Last Thursday, a court in Jos set aside the NFF elections, which brought the NFF board headed by Pinich to office last month. This handed power to a faction headed by Chris Giwa. FIFA does not recognize the jurisdiction of civil courts in football matters. Instead, aggrieved parties are welcome to present their cases to the Court of Arbitration in Sports, CAS, whose headquarters are in Lausanne, Switzerland. This is the fifth time since the end of the FIFA World Cup in July that Nigeria has been warned of a possible ban from international football as a consequence of power struggles over who is in charge of the NFF. In Nigeria, a frustrated Nigeria sports minister, Tami Danagogo, on Tuesday appealed to the Nigeria football stakeholders to prevail on the Giwa and Pinich factions to withdraw their cases from the civil courts in Jos and settle their dispute amicably. Danagogo made the plea in Abuja after meeting both factions separately and failing to find common ground to avert this serious crisis. He urged both parties that in the event of a deadlock, they are free to withdraw their cases from the civil court and take their case to CAS, whose arbitration is final and binding in all sports matters worldwide. Meanwhile, as usual, the immediate casualties of a potential FIFA ban on Nigeria will be the hard-working football players. Nigeria's Super Eagles are African champions and will be denied a chance to defend their title next January. Nigeria are also FIFA Under-17 World Cup champions, while the Nigeria Under-20 side are contenders for the Africa Under-20 Championship title and a place at the FIFA Under-20 World Cup next year. Both teams will be out of action in the event of a FIFA ban, while the Nigeria Super Falcons, winners of the just concluded Africa Women's Championships, will have their preparations for the 2015 FIFA Women's World Cup in Canada significantly affected. Therefore, the fate of Nigerian football lies squarely in their hands. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And that's it for this Wednesday, October 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Strike, as well as sports editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Butter in Washington saying, have a nice day, Africa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
Hello, this is Sunday Shomari. Join me every Monday for your lighthearted show, Let's Talk. That's right, Monday at 17:30 UTC for interviews, great music, and a whole lot of laughter. Right here at the VOA Africa. Keep it locked. VOA Africa, don't miss.